Chapter 1 White Sticks.
I wish you wouldn't play that abominable game, Jen. You can ill afford to break a finger so near the end of your apprenticeship.
Jen smiled at Raphael. His old master's wispy grey hair and skeletal face always evoked a strange mixture of humour and pity in whomever he addressed, but Jen's long association with Raphael lent him an immunity to the bard's pathetic entreaties.
Have you looked outside? Do you really think I'm going to stay?
Not to mention,
Raphael interrupted, raising his voice,
the misfortune of losing an eye or getting a huge scar on your forehead. I've not known one successful bard with a scarred face or missing body parts. Save what good looks you have, lad. You certainly don't have a surplus to squander on a silly game.
Jen grabbed his cloak, hurrying to get in as much recreation as possible. Autumn in Tell rarely offered a day as beautiful as the one that beckoned to him now. While Jen knew that Raphael, as his master, had every right to order him to stay indoors, he rarely chose to issue such demands. Jen's own desire to excel at his craft and the affection that existed between him and Raphael obviated any need for rigid strictures. However, even if the old bard did order him to stay inside, Jen thought he might just disobey. Harvest Festival had ended the day before, and no one had worked harder than he and Raphael. Magistrate Scholes demanded they perform and sing so much during the week-long celebration that afterward Jen genuinely felt sick of playing music and telling stories, an exhaustion he had never felt during all his years of apprenticeship. What he needed now was mindless, brutal fun with young men of half his intelligence, one-fourth his breeding, and one-tenth his vocabulary. The Sons of Woodsmen provided just such entertainment. While they could certainly break his arms and knees with ease, he could make them look like idiots with equal facility. Half the time they didn't even know they were being sported with. But Jen did possess two redeeming qualities to aid him in physical games. He was tall, and he was fast. Most peasants in the kingdom of Tolnor were short, stocky, and of a dark complexion. Jen, in contrast, stood a head taller than most of his peers in Tell, and had a fair complexion, light brown hair, and green eyes. Raphael, who was himself from Rugoth, told Jen that he looked Rugothian, though in the larger cities of Tolnor there was a greater variety of peoples than were found in the country dukedom of Duke Norshwal of Greytower. Jen opened the door of the two-story farmhouse that he and his master occupied alone in what the townspeople called a shameful waste of a big house. Raphael, a freeman, had bought the seven-room home from Baron Forthrickshire, and had proceeded to fill it with belongings acquired from a lifetime of travel, brought in on wagons from several origins. Jen dared only once to ask Raphael why a bard of his obvious attainments and property chose a remote town to live out the remainder of his days. The hurt look in Raphael's eyes and his terse reply that it was none of his concern held enough emotion to persuade Jen to abandon the subject forever. With a wave to his frowning master, Jen bounded down the porch's three steps and into the brisk afternoon wind. High clouds moved quickly over the tall trees of the Alewine Forest to the west, hinting at a change in the weather that thankfully had remained clear and sunny during the harvest festival. As he walked, Jen tied his shoulder-length brown hair into a ponytail to keep it from interfering with his vision during the game. Raphael's concern for his pupil's health was not unfounded. While white sticks most often resulted in only minor bruises, Edmondson, the town farrier, lost an eye to the game in his youth, and Jen's friend Gant broke his forearm, an injury that threatened to end his apprenticeship as a woodsman. While Gant's wound did heal satisfactorily thanks to the ministrations of Pure Man Millisham, Gant's master strictly forbade him from playing the game ever again. Of course, the prohibition hadn't stopped Gant at all, and his master knew it. If anything, Gant treated the game with even more reckless abandon than before, and for the last 2 years, whatever ministrants presided over the game of white sticks blessed Gant plentifully. Jen thought Gant's run at white sticks legendary, but he suspected that his friend excelled at it because he had such a high incentive not to get hurt. His master would undoubtedly punish him harshly for another injury, and Gant loved his master's daughter, Yarl. Gant waited for Jen where the green road intersected with a small lane that ran into the forest. Gant was less stout than his peers, while still possessing the powerful frame, and his brown hair had just a hint of red in it. He stood with his thumbs hooked under the frayed rope that held his pants up, face happy at the sight of his friend and with the anticipation of an afternoon of sport. The country boy's smile jutted up and down like a tortured mountain range, lending his countenance a ridiculousness and innocence.
"Gant," Jen greeted cheerily, "a fine day for white sticks."
"Yep," he replied, falling in beside Jen, "though I expect the wind will play tough with the throws. You ready for the shoals, boys?"
"You arranged a game with Jakes and Howan. How did you manage that? Those two won't come within 40 feet of a peasant.
I believe they think peasantry is a disease they might catch. Jakes actually puts a cloth over his mouth when he has to talk to me."
"You might be the clever one and all, Jen," Gant answered, "but I know how to place a barb under a saddle. After we won against Dirk and Gover, I let it drop in places I knew it would get round that you said it was just as well that Jakes didn't never play against us, since he throws like a girl."
"Wonderful," Jen said. "I don't think they hate me quite enough yet."
"I always like to help when I can. But not to fear. There'll be plenty others about. I'd wager we'll only have a few rounds to knock 'em around a bit, and then we'll let some of the other boys peck at 'em. Just thank Eldaloth that Hubert ain't here. Dumb as an ox, but I hear he can throw like a gaggon."
Hubert Scholes, the eldest son of Magistrate Scholes, was a lumbering brute of a young man who, despite his violent temper and absurd behaviour, was his father's favourite, and spoiled accordingly. By some extremely fortuitous arrangement of his father's, the boy managed to secure a position in Duke Norshwell's contingent of foot soldiers. Everyone, his own brothers included, celebrated his departure.
"I bet you're hoping for a certain young lady to see your performance today."
"It is not necessary for you to bring her up every time we get together, Gant," Jen returned glumly.
"Oh, come on, Jan. You like her. You're about the marrying age. Fess up.
Of course I like her, you dolt. Doesn't everybody? I suspect you do too, despite whatever feelings you have for Ural."
"Nah," Gant rebutted as he picked at the calluses of his palms. "Regina's too uppity for me. You two were made for each other. You're both as pale as birch and use words no mouth within 50 leagues of here has any right saying.
She's a free man, Gant. It's going to take me years to earn enough money to purchase that status."
"How long did it take Raphael?"
10 years. But he was better than I am and played in Rugoth, where it is more lucrative."
Jen wasn't sure if Gant knew what lucrative meant, but a gathering of young folk ahead of them drew their attention back to the impending game. Jen eyed the crowd expectantly, disappointed to find Regina missing, but surprised at the number of people there nonetheless. Jakes and Howan obviously invited everyone they could find. They stood in the centre of the throng, a large leather bag propped up against Jakes's leg. Jakes and Howan, stoop-shouldered twins, appeared to be putting on a little girth. Like their father, shockingly red hair and small eyes punctuated bland, puffy faces. Jakes and Howan had every one of their older brother's deficiencies of character, but in addition possessed a sullen meanness, cultivated from living with a boorish favourite their entire lives. In the realm of stupidity and brash behaviour, they were crowned kings. Jen avoided them as often as possible, though he did take some delight in abusing them to their faces without them knowing it.
"Jakes, Howan. Or Howan Jakes," Jen greeted brightly. "I'm not sure that bag is big enough to hold all your ignominy."
From the blank stares all around, Jen knew he was alone in understanding the sentence.
"It is too big enough," Jakes returned crossly. "We didn't want to play with your stupid sticks, so we got our part to get us a real set with real Uyumark bones."
Jakes turned the bag over dramatically and the white sticks fell out, everyone pressing in for a better look. By the sound of the sticks knocking against one another, Jen knew immediately the set was not fashioned from bones at all, but from some hard wood carved to look like them. Sets of real Uyumark bones were very hard to come by, and extremely expensive. Uyumark, the principal soldiers sent against the nations during the Mekikian Wars, were considered all but extinct by most. The game of white sticks was born from the mind of idle soldiers who had invented it during lulls between battles using the bleached leg and arm bones of Uyumark hunters. Over time, the sport spread through the ranks of the human kingdoms, growing in popularity to the point where the rules solidified and soldiers formed leagues within military legions. The game involved forming a square, called the box, out of the long leg bones. At a distance of 20 paces from opposite sides of the box, one arm bone rested in a cradle, formed by 2 sticks pounded into the ground. Each team of 2 consisted of a thrower and goaler, each holding an Uyumark arm bone. The throwers started inside the box and on go, ran toward the opposing team's cradled bone. The object was to bat the opposing team's bone as far away from the box as possible. After batting the opposing team's bone, the throwers had to run, circling around to retrieve his team's bone, directed by the goaler. Once retrieved, the thrower could score points by throwing or placing the bone in the box first and by getting it all the way inside the box. The goaler's job was to distract the other team by chucking his bone at them. He could also use a precise throw to knock their already placed bone from the box. As he helped set the game up, Jen decided that despite the bogus bones, the Scholes' set of pieces outclassed anything they had played with before. The white bones felt smooth and heavy, far superior for throwing in the wind than the lighter, roughly carved pine sticks they normally used. Anyone hit with one of these bones would have a nice bruise to show for it, and the crowd backed away to a safe distance as Gant, Jen, and the Scholes brothers finished setting up.
"We've played against nobles," Jake bragged,
holding a cloth over his mouth as he came close to Jen and Gant. "Did you win any of the games?" Jen asked. Jake paused, taken aback by the unexpected question.
"Of course we did," he protested, with enough heat to reveal the obvious lie.
"Congratulations," Jen replied sarcastically. "You should have no problem with a couple peasant louts, should you? I mean, it's hardly fair that we malnourished, dirty peasants should have to face such well-fed, experienced players like yourselves. It bespeaks a horrible inequity that begs attention and redress, and I fully anticipate that if you were magistrate some day that you would take upon you the manly yoke of righting these injustices." Jakes squinted, having gotten lost somewhere around bespeaks.
"Don't listen to him, Jakes," Howan growled, grabbing his brother by the arm. "He talks too much. Let's play."
Jen started as the thrower, lining up in the box with Howan. Jen faced Jakes and on go ran forward and knocked the Scholes' bone high in the air and to the left before running back toward Gant, who signalled where theirs had fallen in the grass. Jen retrieved it quickly, waiting to see if Jakes would throw at him, but when he turned around to face the box, Jakes was yelling at Howan and telling him he had no idea where the bone had gone. Jen, realizing he had all the time he wanted, walked casually back toward the box at a leisurely pace, Jakes watching him carefully, bone cocked back and ready to throw. Jen braced himself for Jakes's throw, and when it came, he turned and looked at Gant in shock. Jakes really did throw like a girl. The bone barely went 10 feet before skidding to a halt in the dirt. Snickering erupted in the crowd. Jen, having the luxury of placing the bone in the box rather than throwing it in, situated it in the exact centre to get 2 points for being the first to put it in and 3 for getting it inside the box without touching any of the sides. When he looked up, Howan was still bent over rooting in the grass, butt crack grinning above the rim of his pants. Not wanting to waste an opportunity, Gant reared back and threw his bone as hard as he could, hitting Howan's ample backside with impressive accuracy. Howan got a bruised tailbone and a face full of dirt and grass. In the end, Jen helped Howan find the bone. Since Jen had already scored, the rules forced Howan to make his throw from the spot where the bone had fallen. He missed horribly. The first round robbed the hulking brothers of their bravado, and by the fourth, Jen and Gant succeeded in stripping them of their dignity, self-respect, and whatever maturity they could lay claim to. They whined, threw fits, and hurled poorly supported accusations of cheating, demanding Jen and Gant switch sides of the box with them twice. But despite the twins' deep bruises and the mocking of the crowd, they demanded one last game to decide everything once and for all, and that the score, which had risen to 18-6 in favour of Jen and Gant, be put at 0. Jen and Gant agreed and met to discuss their strategy.
"Can't take no glory in this," Gant grumbled, spitting on the ground. "Never played against poorer. Played against nobles. Pho! Bloody liars." "It might not have been a lie, though.
Nobles is probably the surname of a couple blind lame boys. Jed and Davy Nobles, maybe.
Right,
Gant smiled. You want to do anything special? Do we need to do anything special? Perhaps play blindfolded and throw with our offhands?
Done that last round, Gant said. The offhand thing, I mean.
Really? I didn't notice. Well, if we win, they'll say we cheated, and we'll be on the run from a beating. Since I'll be the goaler, I'll save my throw so I can use it to help us get away, if need be.
Jen placed the arm bone in the saddles of the two sticks, and waited as Gant and Jakes lined up in the box. On go, Jakes tripped Gant as he started to run, sending him hard to the ground. Gant grimaced and struggled to his feet, holding his left arm, which lay limp at his side. Jakes sprinted toward Jen, batting the stick and turning back. If Jakes could get back to the box before Gant hit their bone, they would win. Gant stumbled forward and hit the bone in time, but it flew low and landed only a few feet away from a grinning Jakes. Still nursing his arm, Gant ran slowly to find the bone that Jakes had hit. While Gant struggled, Jakes dashed straight to where the bone Gant had hit lay, glee plastered to his face. Jen knew he had one chance to keep Jakes from scoring. Jakes would have plenty of time to get to the box and put his team's bone in before Gant retrieved theirs. Jen had to slow Jakes down. Jen signalled to Gant, indicating where their bone had fallen, and then turned and threw his bone at Jakes just as the boy was standing up from picking up his team's bone from the ground. As soon as he released the bone, Jen wished he could have pulled it back. Time slowed to a crawl. Jen could pick out each anxious pair of eyes in the crowd as they followed the bone, tumbling end over end toward its target. Jakes stood, planted his feet, and turned back toward the box, just as Jen's heavy wooden bone arrived. The rounded end smashed into Jakes's mouth with a sickening crunch, sending his teeth flying out of his head in a shower of red and white. Jakes's head snapped back and he landed flat on his back, dust rising around him from the heavy impact. Everyone winced, and the girls in the crowd gasped, bringing hands to open mouths. Howan abandoned his post to check on his writhing brother. Jen was glad Jakes was writhing, and not dead. A pale Gant jogged slowly to the box and dropped the bone in. Jen met him there.
Are you all right, Gant? Jen asked. My arm hurts bad. What happened? What did you do to Jakes?
I'll explain later. We'd best leave. Let's get to town and have the pure man care for that. He might be able to fix it up well enough to escape your master's notice.
Hey! Howan bellowed as they turned to go. Get back here!
You keep going, Gant, Jen said. I'll take care of this.
Gant nodded doubtfully and started toward town, some of the crowd splitting off to follow him, trying to get a look at his arm. The balance stayed to watch the outcome of Jakes's felling. Jen turned and got his first glimpse of Jakes's new face. Howan had helped him up, and they stood side by side, both seething with rage. In his agony, Jakes had smeared blood all over his face, and his lips had already puffed twice their normal size, a throbbing purple and black, colour drained from Jen's face.
My teeth, you bastard!
Jakes yelled, more teeth and blood spraying to the ground. As one, the two brothers lumbered at Jen like angry she-bears. Jen turned and sprinted toward town as the crowd cheered him on.
Meet me in the church, Jen yelled to Gant as he passed him.
Jen didn't have to run very long before Jakes and Howan gave up, poor conditioning hindering their strong urge to pulverize the bard's apprentice. Jen kept a quick pace toward town anyway, not wanting to give his pursuers any chance to catch him unawares. He didn't think he would survive the encounter. The church was his only sanctuary. Pure Man Millersham brooked no fighting anywhere, especially on church grounds. Jen jogged into town, greeting the few people still around in the late afternoon. Tell's town centre held but one distinction. Some generations back, one of the more thoughtful magistrates somehow secured funds from the baron to pave the small square with imported cobblestones. Even after a heavy rain, the square remained pleasant, bearing only the mud tracked onto it from boots and wagon wheels. Four buildings surrounded the square, the Scholes' sprawling home, the church, the Morwald's store, and a run-down inn, the Honey Fly. Like his master, Jen was well-liked by the townspeople for his good manners and happy disposition. As he opened the oak doors of the whitewashed church, Your man Millersham stopped his sweeping and smiled.
Well met, Jen, he greeted. How did your game go? I can tell by your face that something is amiss. What is it?
Jen took a couple of minutes to catch his breath. Pure Man Millersham regarded him patiently. The Pure Man was tall and bald, and he possessed penetrating blue eyes that could drag the truth from the most recalcitrant liar and yet be comforting in turn. Jen decided that all holy men should have eyes of blue and a strong chin. Something about the combination invited reverence and respect.
Gant hurt his arm. Oh, no, not again, Millersham said, frowning. Is it bad?
I don't know. I'll prepare that there's more.
More? Millersham asked, eyebrows rising.
Yes,
Jen admitted, looking at the floor.
Jenks's mouth is, in a sad state of disrepair. And I can see by your sheepish look that you are guilty of the infliction.
Not on purpose, Jen burst out hastily,
realizing that Pure Man Millersham might think he had punched the lad.
One of the bones I threw at him had the misfortune of catching him in the teeth.
So the bone had the misfortune, then?
No, sir. I meant to say,
did he lose any teeth?
A fair number, yes.
Fair number?
More than three.
Less than 10, I think.
I don't suppose they bothered to gather them. I can fix some of the damage if I have them.
I didn't see that they did. They were too busy charging at me to worry much about the teeth.
I see. I will prepare for an injured arm and a broken mouth, then. It would be best if you were not here when Jakes comes. His father will no doubt need several moments to cool down.
It would probably take more than several years. The Scholes family hated Jen for the town's good opinion of him and for his good breeding. The Scholes placed orphans in with the lowest of social refuse, considering them double bastards for all practical purposes. It irked the magistrate that people said Jen could pass for a lord while passing his own children off as even educated would be like telling someone a chicken was a peacock. The magistrate and Lady Scholes never connected the fact that they indulged their children in everything with their children's poor behaviour, and they, and consequently the whole town, suffered for it.
I suppose I'll go home, if you'll tell Gant to stop by and—
Oh, no, Jen,
the pure man said as he rifled around in the closet.
I mean for you to go and find what you can of Jake's teeth.
What?
You heard me. Now off with you. You owe Jake's that much, and it might go some way toward mollifying our good magistrate's unavoidable explosion of temper when he hears about this.
Jen swallowed his pride and left through the rear of the building, taking the long way back to the clearing to avoid Jakes and Howan and any of the crowd that might still be returning from the game. By the time he arrived at the blood-flecked grass, the sun had dipped behind the line of trees, casting the spot into shadow. Jen strained his eyes and worked until only the moon's Min and Duum were left to cast their light. Triss, the third moon, was an eclipsed hole in the sky, as it had been for hundreds of years. The shards of their broken world sailed through the night sky, edges reflecting the fire of the setting sun as they moved and spun behind a misty veil of thin clouds. Jen opened his hand to see the fruits of his labour. All his scrabbling in the grass produced five teeth, and the pieces of a couple of others, before the darkness prevented further search. He started for town, stomach clenched in dread. He walked at a meandering pace, hoping against hope the Scholes would have come and gone by the time he arrived, but as he entered the chapel his heart sank. There, on the back row, sat the entire Scholes family, Magistrate Bernard, his wife Serena, and their sons. They stood as he entered, faces angry. Jakes remained sitting, holding a compress against his mouth. Howan strode over and shoved Jen roughly. Jen fell backward against a pew, losing his grip on the teeth as he braced himself for the fall. The teeth clicked on the wooden floor as they bounced about.
Howan!
Millersham thundered. Jen looked up to find the brute towering over him, probably torn between 50 choices of how to hurt him. The pure man interposed himself between the two boys, and Jen struggled upright, back bruised.
For that, Howan, the pure man said calmly, you will need to find your brother's teeth on the floor.
"Indeed he shall not,"
Bernard bellowed, ample gut shaking in indignation with the rest of him as he strode forward to lock his beady eyes on Millisham. The pure man regarded him coolly.
"Jen assaulted my boy! Look at him!"
On cue, Jakes moaned pathetically and lifted the compress from his swollen lips, which, while perhaps a trick of light, throbbed as if ready to burst.
"Furthermore, I am going to have him arrested." "Come now, sir,"
Millisham said, brow creasing.
"White sticks often causes injuries. Don't forget that Jakes injured Gant in the same round. Will you arrest him?"
"Certainly not, pure man. Jakes tripping Gant was purely accidental."
Jakes agreed with a muffled, "Uh-huh."
"Jen's assault was a deliberate and calculated attack."
"It was not," Jen protested.
"Quiet, peasant. Owen, fetch the warden. Jen will sit in prison until Jakes can eat meat off my table again."
Owen sneered at Jen before bounding out the door with a celebratory whoop.
"Magistrate," Millisham objected, "don't you think that is a bit excessive?"
Bernard's face turned the colour of his hair, stubby finger starting to rise.
"I will go,"
Jen interjected before the magistrate could spit out more vitriol. Millisham patted Jen on the back and turned away from the magistrate.
"Let's see if we can find those teeth," he said.
For the next few minutes they searched the shadows of the pews. The Shoals family muttered amongst themselves, the word outrage breaking above the mumbling at regular intervals. Millisham whispered to him that Gant had merely dislocated his shoulder and would recover quickly. Jen thanked Elderloth for that favour.
"That's five,"
Millisham said, finding the last.
"Five,"
Bernard shouted, coming to his feet again.
"But you said there were nine missing."
"We'll look again tomorrow,"
Millisham promised soothingly.
"I won't be able to do anything until the swelling goes down anyway."
"We won't look. Jen will be on his hands and knees tomorrow until he finds every last one."
Howan banged open the door, Sykes coming behind. Jen winced every time he saw the warden. Sykes, once a woodsman, had lost an eye and some of his brain when a fellow woodsman had swung at a tree and hit Sykes instead. From what Jen gathered, Sykes was once a likable sort, but after his injury the man had turned mean. He dressed in black, and a small club hung from his belt. His black hair, perpetually unkempt, shot out at all angles. As a consequence of the injury, he always walked with his head at a tilt. An eye patch covered the hole in his face, the deep furrow of his old wound denting the forehead above it.
"Where is he?"
Sykes asked, lifting the club from his belt.
"There,"
Bernard signalled authoritatively.
"Jen."
"The bard's apprentice?"
"The very one. He is to remain in the prison until Jakes can eat meat again. Tomorrow you are to escort him to the field to find the rest of my boy's teeth."
"Meat? Teeth? Sir?"
Sykes asked, confused. Jakes lifted the compress from his mouth.
"Mickick's breath,"
Sykes exclaimed.
"Pray, Sykes, do not use that name in this chapel,"
Millisham admonished. Sykes ignored him.
"The bard, wallop ye, good one, eh?
Well, assault it is. Come on, boy."
Jen shook his head and walked out the door, Sykes clubbing him on the back on the way out.
"Sykes," Millisham said, "for the—"
The door closed, and pure man Millisham's complaint was lost. Jen walked as quickly as he could, hoping to avoid another painful blow. The prison sat a scanty 50 yards from the town centre. Before the Shoalses, Tell never had a prison. As soon as Bernard was elevated to the status of magistrate by the Baron, he ordered one built. It served as Sykes's home as well, and Jen would have the only bed in the building, forcing Sykes to sleep on the floor.
"In you go, lad,"
Sykes said after lighting the lantern. The cell had no amenities other than the bed and a chamber pot, which, Jen discovered, Sykes had not emptied for a day or two. Sykes closed the cell door and stared at his keys, trying to determine which to use. Jen wondered what the other keys were for, since the only lock in town was on the cell door. Not even George Morwell, the store owner, bothered locking up his wares. After locating the right key, Sykes stared at it as if trying to determine whether to put the key in the lock or the lock in the key. After some consternation and several different keys, the cell was shut and locked.
"You keep to yourself, boy. I don't want no racket while I sleep."
Not being a reader, Sykes banked the fire and extinguished the lamp immediately. A few minutes later, he forced Jen to relinquish the blanket from the bed. In short order, Sykes set to snoring like a drunk, congested sailor, awaking with a screech from time to time, perhaps reliving the wicked blow to his head. Jen finally learned to ignore Sykes's discomforted stirring and fell asleep, only to be awakened by the desperate warden demanding the chamber pot. Unfortunately, it wouldn't fit between the bars, which set Sykes to fumbling with the keys again. Before long, his need became so urgent that Sykes forsook the keys and went outside. The rest of the night passed in a similar fashion, and as the fire faded, Jen could hardly sleep for the chill. When the sun rose, he felt out of sorts and was hoping some of the Pure Man's treatments would help Jake's lips heal quickly. Sykes still slept, limbs sticking out of the blanket at wild angles. He twitched as Bernard Scholes's shrill voice split the calm morning air.
"Get that thing back where it belongs! By Elderloth, I will kill whoever has done this!"
Jen poked his head up to peer through the bars of his window. There, sitting just outside the jail, was the Scholes's outhouse, the words "Free Jen" scrawled into the side. Jen grinned. Hearing Sykes stirring, he dropped back to the bed and pretended to be asleep.
"Sykes!"
Bernard howled, kicking open the door.
"Sykes, get up! They've done it again!"
Jen feigned waking and saw the magistrate in his long johns kicking Sykes in the ribs. At the sight of Bernard in his underwear, Jen couldn't decide whether to laugh or vomit. Bernard scowled at him as Sykes collected himself and stood. Howan poked his head in the door, sticking his tongue out at Jen. Sykes grabbed his club.
"Any idea who'd done it, sir?" "How would I have any idea who did it? Howan, help Sykes get this back to the house."
The three left, voices trailing off. Jen lay back, wondering who his benefactors were, especially since the obvious choice, Gant, had likely been confined to his home by his master besides being injured. Of course, it could be anyone. The people of Tell could do nothing to protest the Scholes's childish behaviour. Entreaties to the Baron only resulted in petty revenge from the magistrate, so the townspeople exacted their frustration with the Scholes family in the only mode available: pranks. And pranks there had been aplenty. The favourite target was the Scholes's outhouse. The outhouse lowered the Scholes's fancy clothes, fancy house, social standing and all, to the same level as everyone else in the town. Pranksters had inflicted just about everything imaginable upon the structure at one time or another. Every animal that could fit had been left in it as a surprise for the unfortunate victim in search of a little midnight relief. It had been knocked down, dragged out to a field, had the roof removed during rain and snowstorms, piled with cow manure, sticks and leaves. It had been filled, broken, hidden, greased and painted in so many ways Jen concluded an entire book couldn't hold the tale of them all. At one point, the pranks became so bad and so frequent that the Scholeses set their boys out to guard the structure during the night, but after a few days their whining, lazy sons gave up. A lock was next, but this idea was abandoned the very next day when someone rendered the lock unopenable by jamming it full of small stones. Jen could only think of two things that hadn't been done to the outhouse yet. For one, nobody had set it on fire. But why would anybody destroy their one source of revenge? The second thing was something so terrible, so heinous, that no one dared to do it. The best thing, however, was that Sykes never caught any of the perpetrators and never would. For just as surely as Bernard Scholes was ordering Sykes at that very moment to track down the dastards who dared move his toilet 75 yards away, Sykes would find that no one had the faintest idea who had done it. The secret society of the outhouse would never give up its members, and Jen took satisfaction in the fact that someone in that society had seen fit to honour him. The days passed slowly in the cell. Finding the four teeth took nearly an entire day, as at least two of the teeth were in several pieces. Raphael came every morning and, after a stern lecture that got shorter each time, always brought a book, which Jen hid under the mattress so that Sykes, who couldn't read, wouldn't confiscate it. Gant talked to Jen through the bars when Sykes was away, and his friend gave him daily reports on the state of Jake's mouth. After the third moving of the outhouse, Bernard forced Sykes to camp by it, which gave Jen the pleasure of uninterrupted sleep for the rest of his stay. To further the Scholes' frustration, the children in town frequently puffed up their lips in an imitation of Jake's face, and to make matters worse, the two teeth that the pure man could not repair were the top front two.
"I guess all his thus will be whistled," Jen quipped to Gant one chilly morning.
"Yep, folks are already making fun of that."
"Can he eat meat yet?"
"I dunno," Gant answered. "He'll certainly have to cut it from now on, so I hope that'll count, or you'll be in here for life."
But after a week and a half of imprisonment, Jen received a sudden reprieve.